The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Fill her up.
You're listening to the Gas Digital Network.
What is up, my fellow addicts? Rob Sutton, the SDR show this week. Oh, man, I was happy about this dude. Will Wheaton, you might know him from Stand By Me. You might know him from Star Trek or even the new seasons of Picard. He comes on the show, and just I get to geek out about all Star Trek nonsense. We do the show every single Wednesday, every single Saturday, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Use the code SDR at gasdigitalnetwork.com. And you're going to get 20% off and a 7-day free trial. But really, we just want you to share it everywhere. That's all we care about. Get it out there. Tell people about the show. And that's really it. That's all I care about. So I'm going to just shut up right now. We'll get right into it. It's Will Wheaton on the SDR show.
This is the intro to the shit show. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll. This is the hit show. Show me a tit show. Please, someone fuck the hoe. It's weed, I'm beat. It's hookers and blow. It's art, it's art. You need to know.
It is the SDR show, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll show. I am Ralph Sutton. Back with me once again, James Madden. How are you, buddy?
Ralph, I'm very excited about this. I have good feelings.
You know
that Beatles song, I Got a Feeling? I have good feelings about this guest. I can feel the energy, and I'm excited about it.
Because, you know, he's kind of like a indie guy, kind of like that. Is that why you're wearing the Sub Pop hat to try and get some points?
I don't even know if he likes Sub Pop. He might be more of a Matador guy, okay?
We'll see.
But I also don't feel like he wants me dressed like the Warriors, but I feel like dressing like I'm trying to keep the Warriors from Coney Island is the right move today. I just listen to the muse and I go with it, Ralph.
All right, fair enough. I'll allow it. So let's say this. Ready? This dude, first of all, happy almost 50th birthday. I think it's a couple weeks away or about a month away, whatever it is. Did something really fascinating we're going to get into in a minute, but actor, author, blogger, voice actor, New York Times best-selling writer. You might know him as Aqualad in Teen Titans, which is where I was surprised to hear his voice not that long ago. But let's be honest, it's Stand By Me. It's Star Trek The Next Generation. And then one of the best kept secrets of the last year, also in Picard, Big Bang Theory, voice of the books for Ready Player One and Two. And then, of course, his new reworking of his book, which I want to talk about as well, called Still Just a Geek. You could follow him at It's Will Wheaton. And it's Will Wheaton. How are you, buddy?
Wow. So many things. You've made me feel so much cooler than I actually am. I am a Sub Pop guy. Although if I had to choose, I would be Kung Fu or Fat Wreck Records is probably where I would go. Maybe a little Epitaph from the late 80s. I love that you recognize Aqualad.
Of course. By the way, I'm extremely auditory. And my other co-host gives me shit when I say that. But like ever since I was a kid, I would recognize voices, and I'm terrible with faces, but I recognize voices all the fucking time. That's just, I don't know what it is. Like, I remember once when I was like 9, they were playing a mystery voice on the radio. And my mother, I looked at my mother and I said, oh, it's blah, blah, blah. Like someone from Gilligan's Island or something. And she's like, how do you know that? And it was that. That's just how my head works. I don't know why that is. But
that is a terrific superpower.
Yeah, but that's my only power. My facial recognition is terrible. So I want to start with this, which I'll tell you a little story, and it relates very much to you. Okay. I have a twin brother. We look nothing alike. But when he was
superpower.
When he was 10 years old, he wrote a letter to himself at 30. And then when he was 30, he wrote a letter to himself at 50. Now I'm 52, right? So he didn't share those with me. But that's what he did in his life, right? So you wrote a book in your 30s.
Yeah.
And now, 20 years later, you're reflecting on that book and you're re-releasing it with some new anecdotes and stuff like that in the book. Let's start with that first. How did this come about?
About 20 years ago, I collected a bunch of posts from my blog and I turned it into sort of a memoir. I say sort of a memoir because I wasn't aware at the time, turning 30, that being in your late 20s is about 20 years too young to write a memoir, right? Like, you haven't lived enough to memorialize things. But in my case, I had packed an awful lot of life into my years up until that point. A lot of it, life that I did not choose for myself and that I was sort of surviving rather than like embracing and enjoying. Mm-hmm. I wasn't fully aware of that when I wrote it 18 years ago. And about 2 years ago, I had a conversation with my editor, David at Harper. He said, listen, I really like Just a Geek, and I reread it, and I feel like there are things in it that you will regret. I feel like there are things in it that you will celebrate, and I feel like it is really worth your time to look at it again, recontextualize it, and talk about your growth and your change and all of those things. And I thought, okay, cool, I'll look at that. What I initially thought I would be doing was looking at this and kind of just owning the parts that are kind of gross and young and immature and myopic. And that ended up being like a really small part of it. Mm-hmm. And the very, very big significant part of it was realizing that the person who wrote that book 20 years ago, the person I was a person who was in extraordinary pain. Mm-hmm. and living with undiagnosed mental illness and struggling to like figure out what I wanted to do with my life and who I was and how as a new husband and a new father and a really struggling actor, like what was I going to do with myself? Okay. And looking back on it now, I see all of the ways I was trying to sort of figure out who I was and where I was going and what was important to me. And the really big thing that was holding me back was that I wasn't honest with myself about what I had experienced in my life and what was important to me. And just before I got into annotating and revisiting Just a Geek to do Still Just a Geek, I kind of reached this moment in my life where I had just worked with therapists and I had done an incredible amount of work to try to understand like why I was hurting all the time. Mm-hmm. The short version is, I am a survivor of child abuse.
You're very open with that. I mean, in watching a lot of your interviews, it is, I think it's wild how now 20 years later, it is very common to be open about this. But I think when you first started talking about it, it wasn't that common. Now it's far more accepting to be a man who was having struggles. It used to, the suck it up and be a man ideal that I grew up with.
I grew up with as well.
Yeah, we're only a couple of years apart. But it's nice. I think it's a great thing now. And I have another podcast, by the way, on health and wellness that we talk about this shit a lot. But it is a wild thing to see now about how it's okay to say I am struggling with this or I'm a victim of this and this happened to me. And how you process it a lot is by talking about it and getting it out there, which is, I give you credit for that. As you were also, I think, one of the first celebrities to blog, you're also one of the first people to kind of get out there that it's okay to be fucked. You don't choose your parents and that shit happens. That shit does happen.
A thing that was interesting to me was like realizing, I guess probably around 15 years ago is about how long it was now, that I have mental illness and it's not a big deal. I have depression, anxiety, and PTSD. And none of that is my fault. It's just a thing that happens to me. And my parents contributed substantially to the chemical changes in my brain and the emotional changes that I had to experience just to survive. And they are both from a generation where mental illness was viewed as shameful, as weak, as embarrassing. Yeah. As
I mean, you're not talking that long ago. You're talking a decade and a half ago and all the way to recorded civilization. It's not like that is what it is.
One of the things that one of the conclusions I have reached in my life, I don't know if this is objectively true or not, it's true for me, is that when someone tries to use shame to stop you from talking about something, it's because your talking about something threatens something that's really important to that person who's using the shame to control you. Either they feel shame themselves, or they are counting on your shame to keep you quiet so they can control you, or something like that. Because of that shame, and because of like just parenthetically, the man who was my father never cared about me, was never open and was never there for me, was never emotionally available for me, never showed up for me. So the only parent I had was my mom. And my mom was just such a narcissist and so emotionally immature that I just lived in that bubble and didn't know any better. And when I saw what was going on, I looked back on my teenage years and my 20s and realized that I suffered, like really suffered, for probably 20 years when I didn't need to. There was medicine available. There were professionals available. There was help available for me. But because my mother was so obsessed with how it was going to make her look to have a kid in treatment, I didn't get taken care of. Right. So when I had the opportunity to speak for myself, I decided I'm going to be the person I always needed, and I am going to be a person who I hope is helpful to other people. Let's get rid of the shame. Let's get rid of the stigma. Nobody looks sideways at you when you get a broken bone put into a cast. Nobody looks sideways at you when you go to the doctor because you have a terrible fever, right? Like, these are all super normal things right. that everybody does. And I've been talking about this for years. Mental health and physical health are just two sides of the same coin. Don't be ashamed or embarrassed because you got a weird thing in your brain. You can work on it the exact same way you would work on like strengthening your upper body if you wanted to lift things over your head or whatever it was. Talking about it has been an enormous part of my healing and has been an enormous part of me being able to claim my own life and put that shame away. By getting rid of that shame, it removed the ability of anybody, primarily my mom and dad, to like kind of control what I talked about and how I felt about myself.
By the way, one of my best friends who was a real big like VP at Viacom and ran College Humor, and he's written articles that came out about him dealing with depression and him going on ketamine therapy. And he's one of the first people to do shock therapy, modern shock therapy. And recently, because he knew it was for his own wellness at my age, he's a year older than me. I think this was last year. So he was probably 51 or 50. He separated from his parents. It's like, I just can't have you in my life anymore because
I had to do that
it's
too
toxic. And I know you've done the same thing, which is wild to learn that, you know, your parents forced you into acting. You never wanted to do it until years later. You came back to acting on your own volition, but much later in life, you were forced into acting as a young child. The kid we all knew and love in Stand By Me did not want to be there. That's pretty wild.
When I was 7, my mom coached me, like prepared me and told me, you're going to go to the agency where, you know, you're going to go to my agent and you're going to go to the commercial agent for kids. And you're going to tell her, I want to do what mommy does. This is what we're going to do. And we practiced it. We practiced in the kitchen, like sit at the table, do all the things. I'm 7.
That's crazy. Okay?
7. I'm barely out of first grade. Okay. And she's like, you're going to go do this. Okay. So I did what I was told. And the way I remember it, I loved the attention from the adults. Right. And I booked a commercial. And in 1978 or 79, I got to go work on a commercial in Lake Tahoe with Bill Cosby, who we didn't know was a monster then. He was a big deal then, you know. And very shortly after that, I suddenly was being taken out of school to go on auditions every single day. We live in Southern California. We lived in the San Fernando Valley, and it's about 6 miles to get into Hollywood from where I grew up. But LA traffic is so bad, that's like an hour.
Right.
And every day after school, I sat on the freeway with my mom for an hour while she listened to talk radio, and I fucking hated it. It was awful. I wanted to be home playing with my friends. I wanted to be playing Atari. I wanted to be doing anything except going to work. So I started saying, I just don't want to do this. Please let me be a kid. Like, I so clearly remember saying it over and over and over again. Please let me be a kid. I just want to be a kid. And my mom did not hear that, was unwilling to hear that, and lied to me about all of it. Like, spent my entire childhood telling me, this was your idea. This is what you wanted to do. You made a commitment, and I gave up my career for you. This is what she told me. And I believed it. I mean, I knew in my heart that it wasn't true, but like, I'm being told this over and over and over again every single day. The house I live in has a man who does not hide his contempt for me, and a woman who's so needy, and I'm responsible for all of it. So like, I don't know what to do. I'm just trying to like be a kid.
Right.
I did a bunch of commercials, and then I did a couple of movies that I didn't want to do, and then Stand By Me happened.
Yeah, I love that you, by the way, James, at 10 years old, he was interviewed by Roger Ebert, and he said he was already a cynic. That shows you how you just know he did not want to be there. It's pretty wild that that happened that early on. It is insane to me. But, you know, I could say that it's the one thing that's interesting. I think both, like a lot of your parts were fatherless parts. And maybe that's where...
You're absolutely right. Every single role I have ever played that has been memorable or important or like objectively good has been a character without a father or without a father figure. I didn't put that together until a few years ago.
Do you think that your love of video games and board games came from the fact that you couldn't be a child when you wanted to be a child?
I think so. I think that's a big part of it. I always escaped into my imagination as a kid. When I became aware of role-playing games, when I knew that like D&D existed, I realized that in these two tiny little books that I had, there was an entire world that I could go live in, and I could populate it with people that I liked, and I could be the hero in that world. I could be all the things that I wasn't in my real life. And then when I didn't have people to play with, I started reading Choose Your Own Adventure books. And then I read the Lone Wolf series. And then I read the dungeon. There were TSR put out a D&D specific line of Choose Your Own Adventure style books. I loved all of that. The game designer Steve Jackson, who I'm very privileged to know, he does Munchkin and Car Wars and Illuminati and all those games. He says every tabletop game is a role playing game. You just have to decide like what the story of the game is and then inhabit that character.
Right.
And that was really, really my experience. I really loved losing myself in those things. So when I got to a point where, also as a kid, you know, I'm working all the time. I'm endlessly working, and I'm not allowed to spend any of my money on anything.
Right. And then your parents stole all your money and spent all your money.
They stole all my money. And I write about this in my book. When I was in my 20s and my wife and I were really struggling, we were living a life that I know, listen, I understand that a lot of people live this life. Okay. I'm not special. But we had this life where it was like, we have to balance the checkbook to the dollar. And we have to choose how much we're paying on a credit card and how much we're paying on a thing, because we were just totally broke. What we did not know at the time is that I was receiving six figures worth of residual checks for all the work I had done on Star Trek and all of those things. My parents were stealing it. They were taking it and spending it on themselves. And lying to me about it. And then during that time, treating me like shit. And my dad especially being really contemptuous to me that I'm not working more, that I'm not trying hard enough, that I'm not taking my career seriously enough. And the thing is, like, I'm just trying to raise my kids. I'm just trying to like figure out what I want. I'm trying to cram the childhood that was taken away from me into just a few years so that I can learn how to be the father that my kids deserve. Like that's everything that I've like really, really trying to do.
And it's also, by the way, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Here now in front of my Tron machine, which I built with my son, Ryan, and I built that together. It was really awesome. I do feel really good about it. And I do like, I've had conversations with my wife. I'm like, do you feel like you're married to a 50-year-old teenager? And she was like, I'm married to a person who loves gaming.
Yeah. Well, I think it's become because we all grew up where games became so popular. Yeah. Gaming, it doesn't seem as weird now because you're almost 50, I'm 52. I had the first Atari game. No one knew that those would stay in the zeitgeist of, you know, culture at the time. It's like, oh my God, you're 20 and you're still playing games. But now everybody fucking plays games. The funny thing though, is that me being a few years older, remembering seeing, you know, you on the cover of like Heartthrob magazines and all this stuff when you were a teen, and you didn't want to fucking be there. It's why, you know, you so don't know the story of people.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
By the way, James, it looks like you've been losing your mind to say a few things, and I apologize, James.
This has been I just want to say this. I don't know if you guys can pick this up. I'm supposed to be like the funny sidekick and snipering it. I've been fighting tears this whole
time. Speaking James's language too. That's why
I am. This reminds me when I was on the plane to LA a month ago, and I was watching Good Will Hunting, and I started gushing next to a dude from Staten Island. I'm like, I hope this son of a bitch doesn't see me. He's gonna punch me and call me all the things that made me have these feelings while this is going on. This is unbelievable, buddy. I'll go fight family members if you want for you. I'm a little younger, but I have two bad shoulders. I know they're older, so that equals it out. I mean, oh my God, I'm canceling all my spots tonight, and I'm just going to eat three boxes of Oreos. I just need to deal. We all need to deal with this to get. Let's Zoom later and eat Oreos. This is insane. I'm going to, if someone played the Kate Bush song right now from Stranger Things, or that goddamn Peter Gabriel song that's been on every film ever, I'll just gush.
From the dog commercials. What's that? I will remember you. That's
oh my Sarah McLaughlin. Elliot Smith comes on. I'm fucking done. I'm jumping out this window. It's only one floor, but whatever.
Switch gears a little bit. I'm a crazed Star Trek fan, right? I've been since the early days, and I'm thrilled that you're coming on and just a big fan. I read an article like a month before you showed up in Picard. That you got, because they brought back, they were really those, especially those first few episodes of the last season, they are trying to get every Next Generation fan to tune in. And there was an article that said something to the effect of Will Wheaton being fucked on the, on this next on the last season. And you knew you were in it and didn't say anything. That must have been like, felt very satisfying that you had this inner secret that you're on, even though everyone was pissed off that you were there, especially because when you first started on the series, you were not loved. And then you eventually became a fan favorite.
If anyone who is hearing my voice right now is one of the people who was excited that Wesley was in Picard, or who was like upset on my behalf that Wesley was not announced as part of season three, I want you to know how grateful I am that you somehow let me know that you care, that somehow it got back to me that you loved Wesley Crusher and that you understand what he means to me and what being in Next Generation means to me. I want to back up a little bit and just sort of like unpack really that moment. Okay. So let's go back to 1987. I am cast on Star Trek. I'm a huge Star Trek fan. Right. Like I grew up loving it. It is my favorite series of all time. It was a dream come true. So for me, objectively, as the little Star Trek nerd, the kid who was terrified of dodgeball, the kid who was always picked last, the kid who was mocked and bullied and teased by everybody, I got to go live in outer space where the stuff that made me weird on the playground made me special and cool in my imagination. Okay. So I get on Star Trek. Oh my God, it's amazing. I'm like, I'm on the bridge and I'm in the transporter room and all that. And what I start to hear is Star Trek fans hate you. Star Trek fans hate Wesley. They hate you, right?
I'll fight them now too. I'll go fight them. Let's go. Give me a time machine.
I'll write them out. Thank you. I know it's not true.
I'll give them the left too. They don't deserve the right. I'll give them just the left.
But before you elaborate, didn't one of the original writers push you to be on Next Generation? Didn't that's how you got on?
Yeah. Yes. I will get to that. It's amazing. So the thing is, you're right, Jamie. It wasn't true. But I didn't know. None of us knew. All we heard was toxic fandom. all we heard was toxic fandom, which was largely young, white, male, insecure, and they didn't like that there was a young person getting in their science fiction.
Right.
Gene Roddenberry wanted Wesley on Next Generation because he wanted a character that kids could relate to, so that kids would get introduced to Star Trek, so that kids would grow up embracing the values of the Star Trek universe, which is infinite diversity and infinite combinations. It's an extremely progressive, secular, humanist world where everybody is valid, and the things, like I said, that make you weird and a target in our world actually make you really special and valuable in the Star Trek world. Okay, so Gene wanted to put that character in, and everyone that he talked to was like, "Don't do that." One of the original series writers is a guy named David Gerrold. David said, "Listen, I don't think this character is a particularly good idea, but if you're insistent on putting this character in the show, you need an actor who can really do this. And I just saw this kid in a bunch of episodes of Saint Elsewhere, where he plays a kid around a bunch of adults. And I think he'd be really good as Wesley. He's also very, very good in Stand By Me. And he has, and I'll never forget this, a legion of teeny bopper fans that will come to see the show." It is because of David that I was even brought to Gene's attention and all that happened. So I'm working on Star Trek. I think at 15 years old, this is going to solve everything. I'm on a regular series now. I don't have to go on auditions anymore. I never have to go on an audition again for the rest of my life. I never have to go sit in traffic with mom like I don't want to. Mom's finally going to be happy. She's going to get all the attention that she wants. So that means that dad will probably love me because I'm finally bringing something valuable to the family that will get his attention and that he will care about. And then a season into the show, not even a full season into the show, I just start getting vilified by toxic fandom and personally vilified by
toxic. How did that happen, by the way, back then? Because there's no Instagram.
I was in fandom. I was going to cons. Going to cons. Like, okay. I loved cons. That was like my place where I hung out. Oh, you know?
That sucks.
I went to cons and there would be merchandise of like sad me being thrown out of an airlock, which like I can kind of laugh about now, but funny. At the time, like,
yeah, now it's funny. Listen, then it's not. Yeah.
The people who did that, and I'm sure those people exist today, and I am sure that they are doing it to kids on other shows. You're adults and you're making fun of children. And right. That's really fucked up.
Yeah.
Because these kids can't defend ourselves. We can't speak up for ourselves. You have no idea what a kid goes through when they are the only kid around a bunch of adults with all of the adult responsibilities inherent in being an actor on a show.
Right.
Nobody listened to my ideas, and they shouldn't have listened to my ideas because I was 15.
Right.
Making me responsible, making me a target, was cruel and lazy, and it really hurt. And here's the thing, it confirmed for me, oh my God, my dad's right about me. This didn't fix anything. Everything is exactly the same. I didn't realize at the time there was nothing was going to fix what was unfixable with those two people. But I didn't know that as a teenager.
Right,
all I knew was my dreams have come true. Why is everyone so mean to me? And it really, really hurt. So let's come back to now. When Wesley is not included in the big cast announcement, more noise is made, more articles are written, more words are said about how fucked up that is than were ever written or said about We Hate Wesley. Like, it's incredible.
That's
like, just
wild.
It was just this, and honestly for me, I felt celebrated, I felt validated, I felt so seen, and I felt this joy for the little boy that I was, that 15-year-old who went home into his bedroom, listened to the Smiths and cried because he was so sad and so lonely and so afraid and just so just like invisible in every way that mattered to him. I celebrated the little boy who I used to be. When the last episode of season two of Picard dropped and Wesley showed up. You talked about hearing people's voices and recognizing people's voices. I have heard from a lot of people who have told me, you know, I saw Corey there and then I heard a voice and thought, God, that sounds like Will Wheaton, but that can't possibly, you know, and it just, so that came, that week happened the same week that Still Just a Geek became a New York Times bestseller.
Oh, wow. That's so cool.
It was like in just a few days, the world, the universe was like, hey, teenage Will Wheaton, you're so sad and you're hurting so much right now and you're enduring all of these things and it's going to be okay. Yeah. There's a day in your life where you realize everything that you need to be happy is inside of you and all these people show up to celebrate it. And it was like, oh, I was always worthy of love.
Yeah, just too bad it took 30 plus years to get there. And also, by the way, in watching that doc about Star Trek recently, the center chair, the center seat, something like that, I didn't realize how Gene's voice was not as easily permeating into the series as he wanted it to be. So you're lucky that you even made it in the first place. That's pretty wild.
Yeah. I think that the writers really, you know, they struggled with Wesley like they struggled with everybody for the first couple of seasons. And around the time that they really figured Wesley out, I was done. I had just, you know, it was just too much for me and I left the show. And that is, we could do a whole hour just on that choice.
Right. I want to ask a couple of questions on this.
Haunted me. And now how that choice feels like, how could there have been any other choice?
Right.
You know, and still you. Just a geek. In Just a Geek, I talk a lot about that character I created proved to everyone that quitting Star Trek wasn't a mistake. It's unfortunate that I created this adversary rather than having a companion who walked with me, who I could have called, like, reassure me that leaving Star Trek was a thing I had to do.
Right.
Also, when Wesley comes back to the Star Trek universe and comes back to Picard as a traveler and comes back with this, like, this world of knowledge.
And such a memorable Next Generation episode. So it's great that that's the storyline that they brought in. You've often said that the Star Trek family became your actual surrogate family. And can I ask who was your father figure? Was it Frakes or was it Frakes. Patrick? It was Frakes. That's cool.
Frakes for sure. Yeah.
And
I wish Frakes were my dad. I wish so hard that Frakes was my dad. And every now and then, Frakes refers to me as his son, and I try not to cry every single time that he does it. Gates is my space mom. When I need a mom, I email Gates or I text Gates. Sometimes Gates calls me just to see how I'm doing.
Oh, that's nice to you.
I feel more loved by the cast of Star Trek than I ever felt loved by by anyone in my family except my sister and my aunt. I feel unconditionally accepted, nurtured, supported, and loved. And I always felt that. And I kind of wish that I had been a bit more self-aware when I was younger, when we were working together every day, so I could have fully appreciated what they were doing for me and how they were showing up for me. I didn't really understand it until I was older and I looked back on like what I didn't get at home. And then I realized that I got a lot of that on the set. And that was really a place where I felt safe and really felt loved.
All right, before we go any further, you know these guys. They've been a longtime sponsor of the show. We're talking about Yo Kratom, home of the $60 kilo, especially now where we're saying inflation is nuts. What did I hear? 9%? Some crazy thing? Inflation is crazy. You know where there is no inflation? At YoKratom.com. YoKratom.com is home of the $60 kilo high-quality curated Kratom direct to you at wholesale prices. Multiple strains, multiple combinations of unique things that they do, unique blends only available there. No more wondering how long has this shit been sitting on the shelf, because they ship it to you directly. Thank goodness for Yo Kratom, YoKratom.com. Plus, you just seem cool buying it in kilos, multiple kilos of Kratom. What more do you need? It's YoKratom.com, that happy feeling you get when you know it's a $60 kilo, only at YoKratom.com. All right, let's get back into it. Let me ask you some Star Trek questions. Ready? A, favorite episode with you and favorite episode without you. Do you have one?
Yeah, my favorite episode with me, I think it's the best work that I ever did on the series, is Final Mission. Yeah, Final Mission, where is it called Final Mission? Wesley and Picard crash land on a planet together, and Wesley has to save Picard's life.
Right,
I think it's the best acting I ever did on this series. I think it's the most real, honest, vulnerable, nuanced performance I ever gave. And a lot of that is because it was so important to me that I carry these scenes with Patrick Stewart, right? Mm-hmm. Like, there's a moment where Picard tells Wesley he's proud of him, and he tells Wesley that he envies him. And I didn't understand what that meant when that scene, you know, when I was 16 or 17 playing that scene, and I watched it recently, and like, I could be Picard talking to Wesley now.
Right, that's cool.
And I love that. And I love that exists. My favorite episode that I've watched, and I think my favorite episode of Next Generation, is Tapestry. Because that episode tells us that our lives are this beautiful, exquisite, complex tapestry woven together of threads of joy and threads of pain and threads of celebration and threads of regret. And if you pluck on a single thread, the whole thing unravels. And it teaches us that we have to accept every little piece of us that comes together to make us who we are. And for someone like me, who is an abuse survivor and a trauma survivor, that lesson is real important, and very like reassuring and soothing to me.
The episode I always use as a gateway for people to get into that series is The Inner Light. I think The Inner Light is just such a great fucking episode. It's crazy how good that episode is. That was
my favorite episode for a really, really long time. Yeah. It was my absolute favorite forever. The idea, I always thought like Picard lives an entire lifetime in a few seconds aside real time. And I've always wondered, like, it's like that game in Rick and Morty where you get to go play a game.
As a person.
I can't remember what the guy's name is. Like, we're going to go play Dan or whatever the game is called. and I always wonder, like, I mean, it would be kind of cool if, like, just all of a sudden the switch turned and I woke up in a tank somewhere. You know, how far did you get in, you know, in the Will Wheaton game? That was my favorite episode for a really long time. And then just Tapestry was.
Yeah. And that flute sold for a fortune, by the way. That flute sold for a fortune on, like, Sotheby's. Did you watch the Family Guy episode of Stand By Me when they did, like, the takeoff of that? And what did you think of it?
I loved it. I loved it a lot. This is probably as good a time as any to just mention, you know, when people find out my story, when people find out like what I went through as a kid, it's very common for someone to tell me they're so sorry for like enjoying the work, or they feel like they can't watch Stand By Me again. Right. And I want everybody to know, like, I want you to watch the work that I did. Otherwise, what was it all for?
Right.
Stand By Me is a great movie. It's a beautiful movie. It's super meaningful to a lot of people. It's meaningful to me. I'm really proud of it and grateful that it's part of my life. And like, I've been pop culture name checked on Family Guy twice.
And you were in an episode as well. Were you in the episode too? Weren't you when you were in that episode when they brought the whole Next Generation cast in, right?
Yeah.
So fucking cool. That's so great. Yes, James.
And the Rick and Morty the game, Roy.
That's right. It's Roy. I knew it was one
with the carpet.
Yeah. And also in the Stand By Me, there was like a viral clip not that long ago where you and Jerry O'Connell were on a show together, and you had a very poignant or meaningful response. It's like, hey, dude, you were 11. Like, you know, nobody's aware that you're going through trauma because trauma victims are good at hiding it. But you stayed friendly with Jerry all this time, or no? I know you don't really talk to
Corey. Absolutely, yeah.
You don't talk to Corey anymore, and you dissipated with River before he passed. Correct, right?
River's life and my life went in real different directions. I saw in River uncomfortably familiar pieces of myself reflected back to me. I don't know what he experienced, and it's not appropriate for me to speculate,
right,
but I can tell that he had experienced things that kids shouldn't experience. And there was this moment in our lives where he got close with just people that I didn't like. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like, I'm not making a value judgment about people who choose to like use drugs and stuff. But like, it was an environment that I was just aware of from the time I was really young. And I thought, this is a predatory environment. This is an unsafe environment. And also, I don't like these people. Mm-hmm. These people are gross. They remind me of the worst parts of my mom. Like, I don't want to be around these people at all. So we drifted apart. I always hoped we would come back together. And tragically, he died before that could happen.
Right.
Corey and I didn't particularly get along when we were working on the movie. Now, let me be really clear about this. I do not have a single piece of ill will toward him at all. I wish him nothing but the best. I have nothing but love for him. And I want Corey to find the peace that has eluded him for his entire life, because he absolutely deserves it. But he was very much a pain in the ass when we worked on the movie. He was 15. He was angry. His parents dumped him in Oregon and then went back to LA. And like, he was kind of left alone to sort of like try and be on location.
That's wild. That's crazy. Yeah.
I mean, it's ridiculous, right? Yeah. And the way that that expressed itself is, when you get young boys together, it's pretty common, at least it was in 1985, for them to figure out, well, who's the target? And it was me. I was the one that was easy to make cry. I was the one who was really sensitive. I was the one who didn't want to fight back. And that's because I had been conditioned to be that person in my house, right? Like, I'm the scapegoat. My brother's the golden child. That was the environment I grew up in and I was used to. I don't blame him. He was a kid. He didn't know any better. And we've seen each other a few times since then. And he's so kind to me. I think some of the stuff that he does now is kind of gross. It's not really for me, but like, bless him. And I hope that things work out really well for him. Jerry was always kind. Jerry was always sweet and loving and gentle with me. And
also probably because Jerry, I don't mean to speak ill will, but he was like the goofy fat kid that needed, was not as cool. You guys are younger, better looking kids. You know, like, he was a goofy kid. He eventually became this great looking dude, but he grew up. And I do think, I hate to say it, but that has something to do with molding your personality. And I think that might be why he was a nicer guy.
Goofy fat kid right here, baby. You're looking at him right here. Goofy fat kid in living color, baby.
There was a thing about Jerry, man. Like, he just always made us laugh. He made everybody laugh. He was like super easygoing. He just kind of wanted to celebrate cool stuff. Like, he never wanted to like, he avoided conflict, and he just like when you were around him, you just wanted to play and like goof off and have fun. And it is, I think, why he was cast to be Vern. Mm-hmm. Earlier you mentioned how like the roles that my memorable roles don't have fathers. Right.
Right.
When we were doing all the press for Stand By Me, I was 13, and everywhere we went, they wanted to know, like, what do we have in common with our characters? And they all wanted to know if I was a writer like Gordy, and why did I think that I was cast in the movie and things like that. Now, I'm only 13. I don't have the answers to those questions, but I was coached by publicists and encouraged by my parents to sort of tell this story that, like, well, I really wanted to be a writer, which actually was true. Mm-hmm. You know, that I just worked really hard to be a really good actor. I didn't put it together until, like, in the last 5 or 6 years, mm-hmm. that I was cast in that movie because I am Gordy. I'm an invisible kid with a father who hates him, with parents who only pay attention to his brother, who is never seen anywhere, and all he wants is to be loved. And all he feels is, I'm not good enough. Nothing I ever do is good enough. That's exactly who I was. Mm-hmm. Corey was the only actor. I asked Rob Reiner this question, and he told me that Corey, I was like, why'd you cast this guy? He's such a pain in the ass. And Rob said, the only actor I saw who had the anger and rage that Teddy has because of the way he was mistreated. Corey was mistreated by his parents the way Teddy was mistreated by his parents. Mm-hmm. River had lived more at 15 than anyone should. And Jerry always made everybody laugh. Like, right. That's how each one of us fits into that movie. And it's why that movie endures. And it's why audiences across two generations now have found some kind of kinship with the characters and relationship with the movie. And it's difficult for me to accept that now. It's painful to watch it. I watched a little bit recently and it was very hard. I could just see the sadness in my eyes. I watched some of the first season of Next Generation recently and I was very aware of the sadness in my eyes and just about my whole, the way I carry myself, all of it. And it's so undeniable. And I wonder, like, who else saw that and didn't say something?
Right. Or they could have just thought you were a convincing actor.
Was there somebody who could have just said, "Hey kid, what's going on?" And I don't know. And I probably would have been like, no, everything's fine.
Right.
But I really,
this is kind of a deep question on that, but this is a very deep episode. Anyway, so you are probably one of the handful of child actors that transitioned into adulthood. Yes, you have your own mental issues. We all do in one way, shape, or form. But yeah, now you're married, you have kids, you seem relatively stable. What do I know? I don't have the internal psyche. You know, whereas a lot of people, as you alluded to with Corey, and I mean, we could make a list of mile long, there's only a handful that transition from childhood to adulthood in the public eye without having some sort of real problems. And yet, you came from, as you've openly said at the beginning of the show, from a problemed childhood. Yeah. What do you think was the reason or the catalyst that enabled you to do this successfully where so many others were not?
I had unconditional love and support from Marion Fife, my studio teacher, from the adults who were my family on the set at Star Trek, from my great aunt and from my godmother. The unconditional love of those people was enough to like keep me alive when I was really struggling and really suffering as a kid. I think that if I had chosen to continue chasing my mom's dream the way she sort of forced me to when I was a kid, that I would not be a survived Hollywood story, right? And it shouldn't be a survived Hollywood story. This has come up a lot lately. People talk about, you know, you survived Hollywood. I'm like, you know, I kind of survived shitty parents. There's a difference.
Right. But you survived shitty parents in the public eye, which is also very different.
Yeah. And Hollywood's a predatory industry. Like all industries are predatory to some extent, but like this is an industry where exploitation of children is just like expected and smiled upon. It's kind of like the Olympics in that sense. And I think it's really wrong to put kids in a place where we have adult responsibilities. If a child's like, man, so I met Ian Armitage, who plays young Sheldon, and his mom took me aside and she was like, he loves this. He's crazy about this. How do I help him just not get broken by this industry? And I said, by asking that question.
Right.
The fact that you asked that question at all is how I know he's going to be okay.
And not only that, you broke it down in some interview I heard where you said that kids in the interviews when you were a kid fell into one of three categories: kids that were forced to be there, kids that wanted to be famous, or kids that loved doing the acting. So if they're the ones that are love doing the acting, I think they're the ones that are going to survive the most, as opposed to the ones that are forced to be there or that are chasing fame.
It's kind of like I have friends who have kids that really love sports, and they really, 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 my friend's son really loves baseball and is like really wants to be a professional ball player. And he's been doing that since he was like 10 or 11 years old, but it was all Dylan's idea. It was like, it's what he wanted to do. And my friend and his wife really support their son doing that. I just think that parents, I'm a parent, you know, we have dreams for our kids. My parents had dreams for themselves.
Right. And they forced their kids into that.
I was a thing, you know?
Right.
And that still hurts. And I think that's going to hurt for the rest of my life.
Right. Well, I mean, that's the thing is, we all have pain. It's just how you deal with that pain. You know, that's a big.
Yeah. And the way that I've tried to take that and just like use it. I've tried to sort of use my experience and my willingness to just not be ashamed and not be silenced and not be bullied into silence to maybe inspire other people who find themselves in their own journeys, maybe where I was at some point in mine, and they just need some kind of North Star, or they just need some kind of like glow on the horizon that says, just keep going this direction. You're going to get there.
I'm gonna rapid fire you a couple of questions. We don't have endless time with you. I wish we did, but we don't.
Okay, great.
What do you think of the Orville? Yes or no?
Haven't watched it.
Wow, really? That's surprising.
I know.
That's surprising to me.
Yeah, I understand. I just haven't.
Favorite post Next Generation Star Trek series?
Okay, so that's like asking me which one of my children I love the most. It tends to be the one that I just finished watching. You know, I get to watch them all for my job on the Ready Room, and I get to see them all months before they're released to the public.
That's nice. I like the new one that's doing a creative thing on Pike.
I love all of them. I feel like Lower Decks is a love letter to the Next Generation universe.
For sure.
Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager. It is a love letter to it, and I'm crazy about it. When I watch Strange New Worlds, I feel like I am 10 years old, sitting on the couch after school, watching Star Trek, the original series, for the first time all over again. And it is the first Star Trek series since the original series to really put me back in that
visceral,
emotional place. And I absolutely love it.
And it has a finite timeline too. It's going to be, it's before Kirk, you know, it's kind of an interesting thing. James, are you a Star Trek fan at all? Or are we speaking Greek to you?
Okay. So I grew up loving Star Trek, and in Vegas, they would just cancel it in the middle of the week. It would be on like at 4 p.m. before the news, and I had TV before 5. And then randomly, some horse shit would be on at 4. I get upset. 3 weeks later, it comes back. 2 days later, it's off. Then it's on a Saturday. I loved it. And then I had Next Generation. It'd be on Saturdays. And then even though I'm a nerd, I got into sports. And then Saturdays weren't available. And then I kind of missed it. But I've been wanting to watch this. I watched the movies. I love the goddamn movies. I want to swim with the whales every time I see Star Trek 4. I'm going to make that happen at one point.
I'm doing that in 3 weeks, by the way.
You're going to swim with the whales?
I'm going to the Azores to swim with the whales. Yes, I am.
Wow, cool.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Right,
I'm going to dress like Spock in that movie, too. And I hope to put someone in one of the Vulcan holds playing a boombox.
I think First Contact is the best of the movies. But I'm not going to ask you to pick one of the best movies, but I think that's...
Pick more of your children right now.
Okay, so I love First Contact, and I just got to have the extraordinary privilege of watching a screening of First Contact that we did as like a special anniversary screening. Mm-hmm. I got to sit with LeVar and Brent and Frakes and my wife while we watched it all together, and that was really, really special.
That's awesome. You know, it's funny, which is just a weird... from what series was it? He was Tuvok. I forgot which series that was.
Tuvok is on Voyager.
Voyager. I was in a TV show with him once as an extra, which I got to stand next. He wasn't playing Tuvok. He was playing someone else, but I got to stand next. It was the closest I've come to the Star Trek universe other than this interview. So I have the quick question. Is it true you got into Big Bang because you tweeted that you liked the show?
Indirectly, yes. It's slightly more complicated than that, but that is what brought me to Steve Molaro's attention. Mm-hmm. And Steve brought me to Bill Prady's attention, and 12 seasons later, I got to work on Big Bang Theory a whole bunch. But
And then what's wild, something I used to use as a kid, you apparently were involved in creating, was the Amiga video toaster. Is that really true?
I worked a little bit in development on the Video Toaster 4000. I primarily worked in the marketing department and traveled around the country doing demos and kind of introducing Lightwave 3D to the like general public audience. Mm-hmm. But I loved it. I was so excited about this. For those who don't know, imagine iMovie. iMovie exists because we made the Video Toaster 30 years ago.
A very, very rudimentary version of what iMovie is. Yeah.
At the time, if you wanted to do professional quality video editing, it cost you around $100,000. What we did was for about $5,000 plus an Amiga computer, which was an amazing computer for the time, you could do all of it. You could do digital video effects. You could do professional things. What we were too early. There was no distribution mechanism for the videos that people would make with the video toaster, right? So like we revolutionized like local news channels and like UHF stations. The adult film industry went crazy with video toasters, switcher effects and things like that because it was inexpensive. And
my home porn production value went off the rails with
through
that.
The ceiling. Incredible what you can do with that. But there was no YouTube and there was no streaming. So like we made this stuff that was available to consumers, but then consumers had nowhere to send their work when it was done.
Right. It's pretty wild.
If we had had something like YouTube back then, I would have invited you to my yacht for this conversation.
Of course. By the way, on a side note, I've talked about this on the show a few times, so I apologize, but I was an early BBS guy. I had a dial-up modem. About 15 years old, I was wanted by the FBI for computer hacking. Like they came to my house. It's a crazy fucking story, but I've rehashed it.
About the same age. So did you know like Lex Luthor and Night Lightning and Taron King and like all
the those fucking hacker idiots. Yeah. I was all part of that nonsense. Yeah.
I knew a lot of those guys. Yeah. I hung out in IRC on the hack channel. That's where I idled all through the early 90s.
Such a long, stupid long time. Okay. Then also a former guest on this show who I think you wrote a book with and you did a show with. Are you still friends with Felicia Day?
Very good friends with Felicia Day. I love Felicia Day.
She's great on the show. She's so cool.
She's amazing. She is a remarkable human being. She is a phenomenal creator, such a good friend. I want so badly for her to write something for us to do. I'm basically retired from on-camera acting. It's a weird thing, right? It's like a thing that I can do. I have the skills. I can bring the characters to life, but I don't like it enough to go through all of the auditioning and meetings and all that stuff. But when someone says, "Hey, would you come do this for me?" I almost always say yes, because like, why would I not use this skill that I have developed, right? Working with her is just so much fun. We have such a good time together. We're like family. Guild together, it was amazing. You know, a lot of people are really big fans of my show Tabletop, and I want to make sure that everyone knows that Tabletop exists because of Felicia. Mm-hmm. Tabletop exists because Felicia called me and said, "Do you want to do a show where you like play D&D on my YouTube network?" And I said, "You know, I feel like playing board games is a little bit more interesting." And like she said, "Well, what if you reviewed board games?" And I said, "What if we reviewed them by playing them?" And then the whole idea came together. And I was we'll get like fancy celebrities to come play games so that people who aren't into games but are into celebrities will watch to see the celebrities and vice versa. And we will change the gaming industry and we will make more people excited about gaming, right? That's the goal, to leave this world with more gamers than were before. And I feel like we were very successful in that effort. And I want to share credit with Felicia Day, Kim Eby, Sherry Bryant, and Jennifer Arnold. In a field that is dominated by men, these women made Tabletop great.
You know, what's funny. We had Joe Manganiello on the show and he talked about
how... Oh, we used to play D&D together.
That's what I was going to ask you. Did you play that D&D games with him when he had like the star power D&D games at his house or something?
Joe has the most amazing setup in his home. He has just this gorgeous room that feels like it is in the deepest, darkest recesses of a castle. It's got sconces and torches and the walls are lined with D&D minis and like amazing collectibles and all that. He has more miniatures and terrain than I've ever seen in my life anywhere. It was really, really, really fun to play together. When we did that episode of Big Bang Theory toward the end that he's in, there was actually a technical error in the dialogue from him. And he was like, I forget what the actual line in the script was, but Joe was like, "Wait a minute, if I cast Fireball, you need to come roll a save against Fireball to see if it works or not. You're not rolling for damage. And I was like, oh yeah, you're right. We need
that's
to change.
Fucking that. Hilarious.
And I would have missed it. I would have totally missed it. And because I was like worried about so many other things on the set that day. And I don't know if anybody else would have caught it. And I was just like, you know, this is why you gotta hire real nerds to do this.
That's really fucking funny. That's really funny. All right, we gotta do the first before we wrap this up, because we could talk to this dude all day.
Oh, can I bring up one thing? Yeah. Well, I think we met years ago. Yeah. If I'm not mistaken, were you at in New York a Doctor Who premiere live?
Yes.
So I did warm up. I'm pretty sure. Yeah. I thought it was you. At the end of the show, we're in the cast bathroom that the audience couldn't. And I believe you gave me a nod, and so did was it Alton Brown? And he gave me a reluctant nod, and it made me feel good because I was still early and doing warm up. And I don't think Chris cared for me. So my self-esteem was up and down all night. And then you guys gave me the thumbs up while my pee-pee was in my hand, but it was still great. And God bless it. You don't forget things like that. I was pretty sure it was you, but I was really scared of really you going, no, that wasn't me. And then I had to put myself on the list of people I'm going to beat up for disrespecting you.
That was so incredible. It was me and Chris and Mark Gatiss and Capaldi, and I think Karen Gillan there that night? No, Karen wasn't there that night because she had already gone on to something else. Who I can't remember who else was there. There is someone in the world right now screaming at their phone. It was, and I just can't remember who it was. I'm sorry, whoever you are. But I want to tell you, Chris, like me, lives with an incredible amount of anxiety and stress and tension and all of that. And in that environment, the level of responsibility he has is so extremely high. And he's IFB'd, so the booth is talking to him the entire time. I've known Chris since we were 17. I can promise you, he loves comedians. He knows how hard it is to warm up an audience. And I can promise you that if you felt that he was not into you, that existed only in your head. That did not exist anywhere else.
44 years of my life in my head.
And by the way, we're talking about Chris Hardwick, if you don't know. And Chris Hardwick, you were college roommates with as well, right?
We were, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so we got to do the first, James, now that you've been vindicated.
The first time ever I saw
the name of the show is the STR Show, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Show. We've asked every guest this since the dawn of time, their first experience with all three, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Rock and roll, we mean the first concert you ever went to. And it doesn't have to be rock, but the first concert you ever went to.
The first concert I remember going to was Fleetwood Mac at the Hollywood Bowl when I was about seven or eight.
What about one you went to on your own volition, though? One that you said, I want to go see this show? Because that the parents probably dragged you to if you were seven.
They did. It would have been the Concert for the Masses at the Rose Bowl. This is the film. This is the concert that was turned into the Depeche Mode film 101.
Yeah.
In Los Angeles. So there's a DJ on Sirius XM named Richard Blade. He is a legend in Los Angeles radio. And I knew him. I really wanted to be a DJ when I was a teenager. I wanted to be in the radio industry more than anything else. That was my dream. And I went to K-Rock every day after work and just sat there and watched them do things. And they let me. And Richard was really, really kind to me. And I think saw that I wanted to do this and mentored me a little bit. At that concert, it was an amazing concert. The concert's over. I'm only 14, and I'm outside the Rose Bowl looking for the person who's supposed to drive me home and cannot find that person anywhere. And I'm starting to get scared because there's no cell phones and I don't know what to do. And Richard saw me, knew me, and he said, are you lost? And I said, I can't find my car. And he said, do you want me to take you home? And I was like, yeah, I mean, I only live like 10 minutes from here. Mm-hmm. And Richard Blade drove me home from the Depeche Mode concert in the Masses.
That's a great story.
That was a really big deal for me. And that concert was absolutely amazing.
And now, the first drug you ever did after weed, unless weed wasn't the first drug you ever did.
Weed's the only drug I've ever used. I've never been interested in any other drugs at all. And I actually wish that weed had been legally available in California. I probably would not have become an alcoholic for 10 years if I had had access to something that was more like, this is like a little bit soothing and also kind of like mind expanding a little bit, rather than here is a thing that just numbs you and is also self-destructive. Right.
Makes sense. And now I know your first kiss ever was actually on a movie. Like, that's how you did your first kiss. But what about the first time you had sex? How old were you?
I was 14 or 15.
Okay. Was it someone you were dating, or was it like a one-off thing, or?
Stupid, horny kids who didn't know any better, fooling around. And like, you know, it was a few seconds of activity. And then both of us were like, this is not the best idea.
Most women after they have sex with me say that same exact thing.
I feel you, buddy. It wasn't until I was like, you know, older, probably in like my early 20s, that I actually had meaningful sex with a person. Mm-hmm. where I was like, oh, I get it. This is cool.
Fair enough. I know I heard you say a story about how when you went to the party, it was a New Year's party where you met your wife, that you went there with the intention of just looking to hook up. And then that's how you ended. That was the time.
No. It's actually the complete opposite of that. I didn't want to go to the party at all. I wanted to stay home. I was really, really happy to stay home and go to bed early. And my friend came, picked me up, dragged me to the party, and then like made me stay there. I was absolutely not interested in anybody. I didn't want to date anybody. I didn't want to hook up with anybody. I wasn't just interested in any of that. My wife, Ann, at the same time, was like not interested in dating anybody, was like had made that whole thing. So we met at this moment where neither one of us wanted to be there. Neither one of us was looking for anything. And it just kind of like, it all just sort of came together.
And so you've been together for over 20 years, right? You've been together over 20 years at this point, right?
It's like 26 years.
26 years. She had two kids when she met you. Is that right? Am I wrong?
Yep. That's correct. So she had Ryan a week before her 20th birthday, and then had Nolan right after she turned 22. They were 4 and 6 when I met her. And I fell in love with all three of them right away. And after a little less than a year of us dating, we were like, I feel like this is something that we're kind of in the long haul on. So like, I'm not in a rush to like get married. That's going to be expensive and complicated. But like, what do you say we start making a life together? And we did.
That's wild. Congratulations for you. That's really nice. I know that also you didn't get tattoos until you were in your 40s, and you have your wife's heartbeat tattooed on your arm, which is really cool.
Yep, there it is.
Yeah, I don't know if we could see it, but there it goes. I see it now. There it goes.
Oh, cool. Man.
Now we're going to do plugs. Obviously, the book is Still Just a Geek, which is I think half new and half old. Is that fair? About a fair assessment?
Yeah. The first half of the book is the annotated 2004 memoir. It is it's nearly 50-year-old me looking back on nearly 30-year-old me. Mm-hmm. I unpack a lot of stories about living with mental illness, about all of my tales of survival, the struggles to be a family with my wife and kids, and how looking at it now, I see a very different book than the one that I initially wrote. Then the second half of it is notable speeches, essays, and other things that I have written over the last several years. And they're also annotated. So hopefully the experience a reader has, whether they do the audiobook or the print version, it's like sitting down with me while I read you my book. And then every now and then I look up and say, let me just tell you a little bit more about this thing just read.
I like that. Cool.
That's the experience that I hope readers have.
And it's Will Wheaton and willwheaton.net. for everything, Will Wheaton. And then obviously probably going to be in the next season of Picard, I imagine. I doubt that was a one.
I am not in season 3 of Picard. Season 3 of Picard has completed production, and I did not work on it. When people were mad about that, one of the things I said was like, thank you for being mad about that. That's really cool. That makes me feel loved and seen and special. I'm sad about it, because it means I don't get to go spend a day with my family doing the thing we did when we were a family full time, right? I'm sad about that, but that's the only reason. That's just more like, I don't know, like I would be sad if I hadn't been invited to the set when they were all together,
right,
you know?
Right.
Like,
although,
It's about that. It's not about ego. It's not about anything like that. It's just about like, oh, I just wanted to have a special moment with people I love.
But I will say there was an article a few weeks before the last episode of last season that said you weren't in that season either. And then you showed up. So that, we have to
But if you look back on everything I saw, everything I said, you will see that I never once said I wasn't in it at all.
Okay, fair enough.
I was very honest about it and just said I was never in season three and then just hoped real hard that nobody would follow up.
Sure, fair enough. All right, Judd, anything else you want to plug before we go around the room to do plugs?
That's it, man. I just want to say thank you to both of you. And like, honestly, to everybody who's been supportive of me, and supportive of people who share my journey and share my story. Like, you know, all of us that have overcome things and that have come through things and have survived things, like we're all kind of in a club that we would rather not be in. But once you're in the club, you really see other people who are in it. And we all kind of have each other's back in this kind of like passive way because we're all sort of showing up for ourselves. Everybody who shares a little bit of my experience, even if you weren't a kid actor, but you share the same emotional experience I had, I just want you to know what it took me a really long time to learn and understand for myself, which is you're enough. You were always enough. There was never anything wrong with you. You were perfect exactly the way you were. It's not on you. It's on whoever it was that didn't see you. That's their failing. That's their loss. You're a wonderful, beautiful, perfect person, exactly the way you are. So am I. We all are. And it is not our fault that people we really wanted to see us were incapable of doing that. Please don't let their inability to love you prevent you from loving yourself.
Fair enough. Do you think you're going to make James cry? James, your plugs?
The whole time, I'm like before this, I'm like, okay, this is now crescendoed. I joked about Good Will Hunting, and now this is the it's not your fault part. And as I said that, you said it's not your fault, and I'm trying real hard to keep my energy up to plug. This was amazing. Will, you're dope, bro. This is, and I needed this today. So thank you. This is what I'm going to go run now and just capture all these emotions. On top of that, if you want to see some raw emotion, everybody, you should go to my YouTube channel, The James Madden. I just put out The Check Spot. It is it's a comedy experiment. It is a special and a documentary. It is the worst part of the comedy show, The Check Spot. It is a love letter to the rawness and dirty and grime and uncomfortableness of comedy. There's plenty of laughs, but there's also a lot of behind the scenes stuff and roughness. And we left it in there and it means a lot. So people go check that out. The James Madden, The Check Spot on YouTube. And yeah, man, I almost cry in that too. What are you going to do, baby? It's who I am, baby. You can't judge me, dog.
I follow me everywhere at I Am Ralph Sutton. My other podcast on health and wellness called Good Sugar comes out every Monday. We're opening up our first location of a brick and mortar store. Is going to be on 3rd and 69th in July. Speaking of July, July 30th, I'm hosting Stone Temple Pilots with...
What?
Who else is on the lineup? ZO2... we're doing a charity event for him. Adler and King's X. I'll be hosting that event July 30th, Long Island, in the Paramount Theater. And just happened now, I confirm we're going to interview the Black Keys next week, dude. We're interviewing the goddamn Black Keys.
Baby, we're doing it.
Shut the fuck up!
A couple weeks for the kid, baby.
Yeah, it's going to be a good
That is so cool!
It's fucking good shit. And Will, I'm going to follow you on Instagram. Not that you need any more goddamn followers. But
you're going to see a lot of my dumb face drinking coffee.
Fair enough.
Good for you. Coffee's delight.
We add a song every week to the sdrshow.com/playlist. I assume you want to add Depeche Mode, or is there a song that's jumping out at you?
I want you to add Damaged Goods by Gang of Four.
It's a great song.
All right, we'll add that. And, dude, thank you so much, man. This was a powerful episode.
I know it's only You've been listening to the SDR Show.